We've now reached the final chapter in our story, the period that saw the breakup of the Roman Empire into Eastern and Western halves. We're going to devote two lectures to this period, this one which I call the Decline of the West, and the next one which I call the Survival of the East. Decline, as I'll explain in a moment, is a dodgy historical term, and I'd ask you to think of it with quotation marks around it. Even though the two halves would remain under one rule for some time, they now began to function separately. And henceforth, it will become increasingly difficult to talk of the Greeks and the Romans as sharing an integrated history, even though there was much that still bound them together. The Mediterranean itself, which in the words of Nicholas Purcell, provided the coherence which united the classical world, will cease to be a catalyst for cultural interaction and change. Nor will the inhabitants of the Mediterranean continue to be the focus of our story, as it now comes to involve the semi-nomadic peoples of Eurasia. So move away, Mediterranean man. Allow the stage to be taken by Eurasian man. In this lecture, I'm going to cover the years from 235 to 540. We'll see that from 235 onwards, when the Emperor Severus Alexander died, there was increasing instability in the western half of the empire, which became a refuge, first for the Goths and later for the Huns and the Vandals. These peoples were not intent on destroying the empire, but rather finding accommodation within it. Eventually, however, the strains became too great, and the political unity of the West was shattered. By 540, it had already passed under the control of a succession of Germanic kingdoms. In the East, by contrast, what we call the Byzantine Empire had, by then, long established itself. The conventional way to look at the period from 235 onwards is in terms of the empire's decline and fall, the title of Edward Gibbon's Magisterial History, published between 1776 and 1787. The decline and fall of the Roman Empire advances the hypothesis that Rome's collapse was due largely to the rise of Christianity, which in Gibbon's phrasing supplanted, I quote, in an unnecessarily destructive way, the great culture that preceded it. It was Christianity, according to Gibbon, that undermined the civic pride and fighting spirit of the Romans. In consequence, the Romans were in no position to resist the hordes of barbarians who crossed the frontiers, destroying much in their path. Actually, barbarian is a highly suspect categorization, since we should not think of these people as completely uncultured. Many of them, though not all, were already semi-Romanized by their contacts with Roman culture, and some of them were eager to take their place in the Roman social hierarchy. Non-Mediterranean is a more accurate description, though for the sake of simplicity, I'll continue using the term barbarian, but ask that you remember that it's in quotes. Gibbon still has his admirers today. He's one of the greatest stylists of the 18th century. And let's make no mistake about it, how you write history plays a large part in determining how many people believe you. Less well known in the English-speaking world is the Belgian historian Henri Piren, who in 1937 published a book called Mohammed and Charlemagne, which argued that the barbarian invasions, instead of leading to the fall of the Roman Empire, merely caused it to undergo a transformation. He noted that the Roman economy did not come to a grinding halt in 476, when the last Roman emperor in the West was overthrown by a barbarian. On the contrary, it was very much business as usual. The real break, according to Piren, came with the Arab conquest in the 7th century. So, instead of straightforward decline and fall, we should think more complicatedly of upheaval and transformation. Before we talk about the period from 235 to 540, I want to give you an overview of the Roman Empire before that period. Gibbon famously writes, if a man were to fix the period in the history of the world during which the conditions of the human race were most happy and prosperous, he would without hesitation name that which elapsed from the death of Domitian to the accession of Commodus. That's to say, from AD 96 to 180, the reigns of the emperors Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus, Pius, and Marcus Aurelius. It may not be entirely accidental that the period most admired by Gibbon coincides with what we have identified as the peak of Hellenomania. Gibbon's verdict may therefore tell us more about Gibbon than it does about conditions in the Roman Empire. In the reign of Trajan, 98 to 117, the Roman Empire stretched from the Euphrates River in Iran in the east to the Atlantic Ocean in the west, and from Britain in the north and along the Rhine-Danube line to the whole of North Africa in the south. Some empire. It's estimated that it covered an area of 2 million square miles, though we shouldn't assume that everyone living within its borders was completely Romanized or that Rome's authority extended to every one of those 2 million square miles. In the reign of Marcus Aurelius, 161 to 180, the population of the Roman Empire probably reached its peak. One estimate puts the total in the Latin West at 38 million, compared with only 23 million in the Greek East, about one-fifth of the total estimated number of people alive at the time. One reason for the disparity between East and West in this period was migration. There were many more opportunities for employment in the West. In 165, a catastrophic plague, probably smallpox, occurred, which reduced the population by about 10%. Demographically speaking, the empire never fully recovered, a fact which exacerbated Rome's inability to resist the pressure on her borders. Not unconnectedly, therefore, it was also during the reign of Marcus Aurelius that the empire first began to experience the threat of barbarian invasions, the threat proceeding mainly from German tribes on the Rhine-Danube frontier, would continue until the breakup of the Roman Empire into two halves. You may recall that in the opening scenes of Ridley Scott's film Gladiator, Marcus Aurelius is fighting back the incursions from German tribes in Central Europe. Very possibly, it was because the non-Mediterranean peoples were not subject to the same disadvantages that were afflicting the Roman Empire, that they were so successful in their assaults upon it. Being far less unified and far less urbanized, for instance, they probably did not suffer anything like as much as the Romans did from the plague of 165. So back to the year 235. First, there were invasions in the west by the Goths and a group of German tribes known as the Alemanni, in the east by the Persians under their king Shapur I. In 251, the emperor Decius was killed in battle by the Goths, and in 260, the emperor Valerian was captured by the Persians. In 267, as we saw earlier, the Heruli reduced Athens to rubble. They also struck at Corinth, Sparta, and Argos. However, they had no interest in settling, and by the end of the 270s, the frontiers of the empire were once again intact. Then there was internal instability in the half century from 235 to 284, when there were possibly as many as 25 emperors whose accession was ratified by the Roman Senate. And that's not including the many pretenders who also laid claim to the imperial purple. All but one of them died violently, many murdered by their own soldiers. The Roman Empire might well have disintegrated under all the assaults from without and within had not Diocletian become emperor in 284. Although we should not assume that Diocletian had some master plan for transforming the empire. As Alan Bowman has pointed out, He probably responded to problems as they came up, as Roman emperors had done from Augustus onwards. Diocletian came to the throne by killing in front of his whole army a Praetorian prefect called Aper, whom he accused of murdering his predecessor, Numerian. A man's got to do what a man's got to do. I'm going to concentrate upon his administrative innovativeness, though he also introduced other major reforms. For instance, in an attempt to curb inflation, in 301 he passed an edict on maximum prices. It didn't work as an economic measure, but it did have some psychological impact by demonstrating that the imperial administration was attempting to take charge after a half century of near anarchy. Diocletian greatly increased the size of the army, perhaps by as much as a third to 400,000. And he also created an aura around himself by making himself more remote and aloof than his predecessors had been. Augustus, you'll recall, had presented himself as the princeps, or first citizen. Diocletian styled himself Dominus et Deus, master and God. Dominus is the word for a slave master in Latin. In fact, we sometimes refer to this period as the Dominate. His greatest administrative wheeze was to divide the empire into two parts by drawing a line through the province of Illyricum, former Yugoslavia. And then, going further south, he drew a line between Libya and all points east and Africa and all points west. Each of the two halves acquired a ruler who took the title Augustus. In 286, he appointed Maximian, a veteran officer who had served under him, to be the Augustus in charge of the west while retaining the east for himself. Then in 293, he took another bold administrative step by providing Maximian and himself with two junior rulers or deputies, each known as Caesar. This was to relieve them of the burden of administrative office, and though it failed in this objective, to help smooth the way for the succession. One of the problems that the empire had faced from the time of Augustus was that the succession was not primarily based on biology, but on adoption. And this meant that there was a constant jockeying for power among possible contenders, each of whom would be supported by different interest groups, such as the army and the Senate. Modern historians call Diocletian's administrative innovation the tetrarchy. Tetrarchy literally means the fourth part of an archē, or rule, but it's used to mean the rule of four. It's exquisitely evoked by a marble sculpture dated around 300, which depicts the four tetrarchs in a huddle, nervously clasping their sword hilts. The statue was looted from Constantinople by the Venetians and is now set into the wall of the Cathedral of San Marco. Diocletian gave the empire a new lease of life, without which it might well have gone under, even though the tetrarchy itself did not survive after him. The empire endured in the west for more than 100 years and in the east for 1,000 years. All the tetrarchs established themselves in cities close to the frontiers so that they could respond quickly to attacks and incursions. The tetrarchic capitals were Nicomedia, modern Izmit in Turkey, Sirmium, a modern Sremska in Serbia, Mediolanum, modern Milan in Italy, and Augusta Treverorum, modern Trier in Germany. Each served as the military headquarters in its own region. So resources were now shifted from the Mediterranean basin to the frontiers of the empire, which now became more important, more populous, and more prosperous. This had important consequences for Rome, which nominally remained the head of the empire, but which became increasingly peripheral, politically speaking. Architecturally speaking, it was still very impressive, and as late as the 4th century, important building projects were being undertaken there. But already, in the 2nd century, Rome was being eclipsed in line with the declining importance of the Roman Senate. In 305, Diocletian retired to his magnificent palace at Split on the coast of Dalmatia, where he occupied himself with the innocent pastime of growing cabbages. Maximian also retired. A civil war broke out among those who believed they should be their successors, after which Constantine became sole ruler in 324. I'll be talking about the reign of Constantine and his successors in the next lecture. For half a century, the empire in the West remained relatively intact. In 357, the Emperor Julian defeated a confederation of Alemanni at Strasbourg and subsequently reinforced the Rhine frontier. Then, in 376, a Germanic people known as the Goths, who may have originated in Scandinavia, petitioned Valens, the Roman emperor in the east, for permission to cross the Danube River. They were fleeing from Mongolian nomads known as the Huns, who were pressurizing them from behind. The Huns eventually settled in Hungary, to which they gave their name. It was a familiar story in this period, one people pressurizing another from behind. And Valens agreed to their request, but he set conditions. First, he limited the number who could settle inside the empire. And second, he required them to convert to Christianity. Third, he required that they perform military service. The empire was at this point facing a manpower crisis. The agreement barely lasted 2 years, largely due to the greed of the officials of Rome, who sought to exploit the Goths in fulfilling their requirements. War broke out, and in 378, the Goths defeated the Eastern army at Hadrianopolis on the borders between Turkey and Bulgaria, killing the Emperor Valens. It was the worst defeat in Roman history since the Battle of Cannae in 216 BC, when the Carthaginian general Hannibal came close to destroying Rome. Some estimates put the Roman dead as high as 40,000, though 20,000 is perhaps more likely. Somewhat surprisingly, in view of the carnage, the agreement between the Romans and the Goths was renewed 4 years later. Rome's eclipse was made official, so to speak, when the Emperor Valentinian made Milan the capital of the Western Empire in 375. And then, less than 30 years later, in 402, the Emperor Honorius chose Ravenna as the capital because of its secure situation. It was protected by marshland and therefore highly defensible. And also because the Goths had settled in the Po Valley near to Milan, the previous capital. Ravenna tripled in size as a result and remained the capital until 476, when the Western Empire ceased to exist. Honorius, in fact, never visited Rome, and it was said of him that he knew nothing of Rome itself, other than that it was the name of his pet chicken. Suspicions and mistrust between the Romans and the Goths continued to run high, fueled on the Roman side by hostility towards barbarians in general, and on the Gothic side, resentment at ill treatment, a fear of the Huns who were continually pressing from behind, an awareness of the weakness of the empire stimulated their leader, Alaric, the name means literally everyone's king, to unite divisions within their body and initiate all-out war. Alaric is a fascinating example of a common phenomenon in this period. He was a non-Roman who sought to achieve status within the Roman military hierarchy and who only after being snubbed turned his talents against Rome. After failing to take Constantinople, Alaric marched westward to mainland Greece. The strength of Constantinople was in fact a major reason why the Eastern Empire ultimately survived the barbarian incursions. He took Athens, Corinth, Argos, and Sparta, and then led an assault on Italy. Though the Romans repulsed him, he returned, and in 410, after Honorius had refused his offer to negotiate, he sacked Rome. He did not, however, reduce it to a pile of rubble. He respected life and property, and even after his men had pillaged for 3 days, a very little had actually been destroyed. It's important to understand that the Goths and the Romans were not implacable enemies. There had been close links from the middle of the 3rd century, notably through trade. The Goths had no desire to destroy Roman civilization. They merely wanted a share of it. Alaric himself had coveted the title of Roman general. And before the sack of Rome took place, as I noted, he sought to negotiate with Honorius. Though the sack did not signal the downfall of the empire in the West, after all, Rome had not been the capital since 375, it must have sent alarming shockwaves. It was the first time the city had been sacked in over 700 years. From this point onwards, the Roman Empire in the West ceased to exercise meaningful control over the eastern Mediterranean, even though Ravenna remained unscathed. Its borders became porous, and the Germanic tribes, the Alemanni, the Vandals, the Ostrogoths, and the Visigoths, gradually acquired more territory within it. In 409, the Romans abandoned Britain. In 411, they withdrew from Spain. And then in 439, Carthage, the capital of Roman Africa, fell to the Vandals. This was a terrible blow to the empire, arguably more significant than the sack of Rome. Carthage was second only to Rome in the West in importance and size. It was a hub for the collection and redistribution of grain from North Africa. And that grain was essential for the population of Rome, supplying in effect approximately 2/3 of the city's needs. And after the Vandals had overrun Carthage, they stayed. In 455, they sacked Rome. The Western Empire contracted to Italy and just a bit of southern Gaul. The Goths established an independent kingdom in southwestern Gaul. The Roman Empire continued to exist in name until 475, when the ironically named Romulus Augustulus, a little Augustus, came to the throne. I say ironically because he had the names of Rome's first king and also her first emperor. Augustulus was the son of Orestes, the notarius or secretary of Attila the Hun. He was only about 14 at the time, hence the diminutive Little Augustus. Incidentally, Orestes is a good Greek name with a very ancient pedigree. The mythical Orestes was the son of Agamemnon, and Agamemnon was the leader of the Greek forces that laid siege to Troy. Clearly, Orestes intended to hold on to the reins of power himself by using Augustulus as his puppet, but he soon ran into problems because he was unable to provide his army with allotments of land, as he'd promised. So his army threw its support behind a German chieftain called Odoacer. Odoacer, a Christian, by the way, had served as an officer in the Roman army before rebelling in 476. He's a figure, therefore, very like Alaric, someone who was thoroughly familiar with the Roman system. Odoacer advanced against Orestes, defeated him in battle near Piacenza in northern Italy, and then had him killed. As for Augustulus, he was given some pocket money, rather an annual income, and packed off home to live with his relatives in Campania. It was a somewhat ignominious end to the Roman Empire in the West, which now ceased to exist as an independent entity. I talked earlier about the controversial views that historians have held about what was going on in late antiquity and whether we should think of the period leading up to 476 as one of decline and fall or transformation and transition, and I'd like to return to that subject again. A German scholar called Alexander Damant has listed in alphabetical order no fewer than 210 of the reasons that have been put forward at various times to explain the so-called decline and fall of the Roman Empire. The H's, for instance, include hedonism, homosexuality, hubris, and hyperthermia. More simply, however, we can divide the explanations into two categories, internal causes and external causes, and the likelihood is that it's a combination of both. The external explanation is pretty simple, all those hordes of barbarians pressing on Rome's borders. But what about the internal reasons? Now, this is where it gets a bit more complicated. A.H.M. Jones breaks them down into 1, political weakness, 2, military deficiency, 3, economic decline, 4, depopulation, 5, an excess of consumers, idle mouths, as Jones puts it, and number 6, administrative inefficiency, and finally 7, a decline in morale. This isn't the place to talk about all this in detail. It's a hugely complicated subject, and I'll just pick up on 3 of Jones's points. First, though the quality of the Roman army remained high, and though fairly small bodies of Roman troops were able to ward off barbarian squadrons that vastly outnumbered them, it became harder and harder to keep the army up to full strength, which in the 4th century is reckoned at about 650,000. In fact, the manpower of the Roman army increasingly came from those living outside the frontiers, who were acculturated to the Roman citizen. Second, there were 120,000 citizens of Rome and 80,000 citizens of Constantinople who received free rations of bread. And other large cities like Alexandria and Carthage also gave handouts to the poor. Then there was the army to feed and the civil service, which ran the army, to feed as well. Economically, the situation was becoming increasingly unsustainable. Third, the decline in morale. The Roman Empire seems never to have evoked any active patriotism from the vast majority of its citizens, so wrote Jones. There was nothing new about this, but in the 4th and 5th centuries, the absence of these qualities became critical. In sum, the fall, in quotes, of the Roman Empire was caused by a number of factors, of which pressure from the barbarians was undoubtedly the biggest single cause. And as for the internal causes, well, it's not possible to determine which was the precipitating one. As Moses Finley wrote, a vicious circle of evils was in full swing. Break into it at any point. The final answer will be the same, provided one keeps all the factors in sight all the time. Back now to the year 476. Odoacer now became the first barbarian ruler of Italy. We don't know a great deal about him, but legend has it that he was illiterate. Wisely, he decided not to take the title of emperor. It was a meaningless title anyway at this date, since the Western Empire only meant Italy. And most importantly, Odoacer wanted to avoid unnecessary conflict with the real Roman emperor who sat in Constantinople. And so, in a show of deference, he sent the imperial insignia, the crown, scepter, and so on, to Constantinople along with a note from Augustulus begging the Eastern emperor to take sole charge of the empire. And in return, the emperor Zeno graciously afforded Odoacer the title Rex Italiae, King of Italy, all in the best traditions of diplomatic tit-for-tat. Ravenna, the former imperial capital in the west, now became the capital of Italy, and in the course of the next century grew increasingly important. Odoacer ruled for about 18 years. Then in 493, he was murdered at a banquet given by an Ostrogoth called Theoderic. Theoderic seized the throne, claiming the title ruler and conqueror of the barbarians. The Ostrogoths, or Eastern Goths, were one of the two main subdivisions of Goths, the others being the Visigoths, or Western Goths. Theoderic claimed to be acting on behalf of the Eastern Emperor, but he actually established an independent kingdom in Italy. He'd spent 10 years as a hostage in Constantinople between the ages of 8 and 18, so he was entirely familiar with the manners of its court and its culture, as too were other founders of breakaway Roman kingdoms who also spent time in Constantinople. When he became king, he appointed a highly accomplished Greek scholar called Boethius to a top administrative position. Boethius was one of the most learned men of his age. His De Consolatione Philosophiae, the consolation of philosophy, drew on both Stoic and Neoplatonic philosophy, as well as on the theology of Saint Augustine. In fact, it was a major influence in the transmission of Greek philosophy in the West. Theoderic died in 526. He'd actually had Boethius executed 2 years earlier on the charge of plotting against him. His mausoleum at Ravenna was the last enduring structure to be built in the West for hundreds of years. From this point onwards, the Latin West became increasingly deracinated from Hellenism. In architectural terms, we see this from the fact that when a classical revival of sorts begins, notably with the construction of the baptistry at Poitiers in western central France in the 7th century, the builders have no understanding whatever of the structural significance of the pediments and columns. They randomly employ them merely as decorative elements. Our integrated world had disintegrated. So what, in fact, were the political consequences of this momentous event? Well, actually, they were pretty minimal. That's because everyone knew that the Western Empire had collapsed long ago. Arnaldo Momigliano memorably described it as the noiseless fall of an empire, and that sums it up rather well. Even so, it does represent a watershed. If nothing else, it heralds, in formal terms, the end of the ancient world and the start of the Middle Ages. Though the emperors sitting in Constantinople would nominally claim overlordship in the West for many centuries to come, the two halves of the empire now went their separate ways. The Roman West would have to make accommodation with a series of invaders, including the Ostrogoths, the Franks, the Visigoths, and the Vandals, who carved out independent kingdoms, whereas the Greek East would maintain its political integrity. Italy remained under the rule of the Ostrogoths until 540, when the Byzantine Emperor Justinian made one last attempt to reunite the Roman West with the Greek East of Byzantium. The Greco-Roman synthesis was not quite dead, as we'll see in the next lecture.